philosophers in space, 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 space.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your pain? Physical
or emotional?
Are we sure we should be paying attention to these guys? It's like who died and left Aristotle in charge of ethics?
Plato!
Sure, we all feel alive now, but how do we know it's not all, you know, just an illusion?
Nobody exists on purpose. Nobody belongs anywhere. Everybody's gonna die. Come watch TV.
Hello and welcome to episode 34 of Philosophers in Space. How's it going, Aaron?
Oh, you know, not feeling very satirical or anything, certainly. Not going to make any meta jokes or do any critiques or send-ups or anything like that. No, I'm doing great. It's great. We had some wonderful feedback on the last episode, and it was a lot of fun. And
fortunately, all the feedback was a satire of the concept of feedback. So, like, while they were like, oh, you guys suck, your show sucks and all that, like, I'm pretty sure they were just, it's like, they didn't literally mean that. I think they were like, oh, check out this form that is feedback, this art form. And like,
the one that was like, you guys just got a major plot point wrong at the end of the movie. And you're right, we totally did.
So, you say we. What was it?
Oh, okay. I mean, it was maybe mostly me, probably. We'll give it like 70-30.
Yeah. Well, speaking of you taking the blame for stuff, I also wanted to say that, like, we did notice, you know, Aaron and I noticed that the last episode got a little light in the philosophy department. And I just want to say, for me, I am fully, you know, prepared to acknowledge that Aaron is 100% to blame for that. So from where I'm coming from, like, I don't, you know, my standpoint, Aaron is ready to fully take the blame and accept that he was wrong.
I'm glad that you've learned from our aliens managerial.
It's hard because
process.
I was just so shocked at how bad the movie was that it really just, I have a hard time when somebody sells me on like, this is the best thing ever. And then it sucks. I'm just like, I can't talk about anything else, but we're keeping an eye on it. I'll try to save those rants for more of the bonus, you know, after dark stuff. And you know, that it works better with profanity anyway. So, sorry about that. We'll make sure to stay on task. And again, blame Aaron. I think we can all agree that he's 100% to blame, both in the fact
Fork
that he sold me on a terrible movie. And just in general, he seems blameworthy. Just look at him. Looks culpable.
This is bullshit. Yeah.
But okay, let's get that. We're going to have a rousing comeback here because we get to talk about one of our favorite shows, which is The Good Place. And we are on season 2 because we already talked about season 1. Mm-hmm. And okay, so let's hop in our exposition zone here, and we'll try to, and we have to do, I think we have to give the spoilers warning. I'm pretty sure we can't really talk about the stuff we need to talk about without spoiling what's going on in season 2. And guys, just watch the show. It's really good. I was wrong. This is an official Thomas was wrong because I didn't want to watch
it.
It
is nice to be
first.
Back on an episode where we can both agree that you were wrong.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm here to acknowledge when I'm wrong and mainly when you're wrong. But this one time.
70-30 still.
No, I definitely was wrong. You were 100% right on this. This is a fantastic show. So you shouldn't get spoilers. Go watch it. It's, you know, it's not that long of a show. Like, they're short episodes and there's only, what is it, like 12 per season, I think. So, and fully worthwhile. So, spoilers warning, we are going to spoil season 2 a bit, but not season 3 or anything. So don't worry if you're not like fully caught up.
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
Yeah, so in talking about season 2, I just want to like go back. You know, the reason I was so resistant to this show at first was because I hated the idea of an afterlife in any, like, even in a fictitious sense. And it was so like that, it was such a turnoff to me that I didn't want to watch the show because it's like, I just, you know, it's just, it's so dumb. Like, this eternal punishment or eternal reward is so illogical that it would be hard for me to like even enjoy it. But this is why I want to bring this up for season two. Season two is where, for me, it really started getting good. The end of season one, season two, because it kind of turns that on its head and you realize there's a little bit more going on than you thought. So this is when you kind of find out that they weren't just in the good place. They were actually in the bad place the whole time, which I guess was the end of season one, right? And then
right at the end.
Yeah, and then going into season two, you start to get more of a picture behind the scenes of what, you know, who these people really are. Well, we'll see. I'm sure there could be several. By the time this show is over, there could be several more major twists and turns. I'm sure it's setting up for that. But for now, as far as we're concerned, season two, they are in the bad place. And Michael has been experimenting with like better ways of tormenting people by, you know, putting them through this whole nonsense of thinking they're in the good place when they're really not. And there's a lot in season two. I for one, love season two.
Well, so we get like the first couple episodes are the constant rebooting that they go through, yeah, because they fall into a pattern of continuously figuring out that it's the bad place.
Yeah. Oh, so good.
Yeah. And it doesn't work for so long that eventually we get Michael agreeing to be on the same team as the humans and letting them stay conscious and not keep getting their memories wiped. And then we sort of get their attempts to all try to basically escape from this place.
And is this, I guess by the end of this season, yeah, Michael's kind of working with them and is kind of has as much to lose or more as they do.
Yeah, he goes through some wonderful changes. I was actually just watching the last couple episodes before we recorded, in the part where he sacrifices himself, or feels like he sacrifices himself in that moment to save Eleanor, is really, really sweet after all of the work they've done over these two seasons.
And then also in this season, we get, probably not too important for our purposes, but we start to get the love story, my favorite love story of all time, between Janet
and Jason. So good. Oh my god, it's amazing.
Janet is really
one of
the most
wonderful things.
So fun. It is interesting to talk a little bit about, we don't totally know right now exactly the composition or the whatever you want to call it, the makeup, the inner workings of people like Michael and some of these other supposedly non-human actors. Like, we don't...
What is the essence of Janet?
Well, we don't... I mean, Janet, if we take it at face value what Janet is supposed to be, then we know what Janet is. But, like, with Michael and all them, like, we don't know... For all we know, the show will end up that he's also human, is going through part of the test or something. Because, like, it is a little weird, the difference between, if we're going to start talking about moral luck, you know, how... It's interesting that it also applies to these people who are working in this afterworld too, you know, which is funny. It's actually, I can't remember if we talked about on this show. Did we talk about this on the show? One of the god awful movies I did, over on GAM as a guest. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was the live show, I think, last year. Was this horrendous movie that had this stupid depiction of hell, you know, and everybody was just like, you know, sitting there like badly acting and pretending they're like suffering, and there's awful filmmaking, all this stuff, typical Christian movie stuff. And right. One joke I made was like, it started doing this like really dumb graphic of about like the number of years. Like, here's how, like, it's not just a short number of years. Like, it's all these, you know, as it's like one with a zero billion zeros, all the stupid crap. And then they showed this little, you know, this, gosh, these movies are so bad. They show this demon, you know, like cracking the whip, essentially, like sitting there, whatever. And the joke I made was like, you know, at a certain point in year 50,000, I would be like, hey, who's the joke on? Like, yeah, sure. Okay. I'm being tormented, but like, you're just working a menial job for like 50,000 years. You know, this demon is just like, as far as we know, he's working like a horrible, backbreaking minimum wage labor for 50,000 years. You know, like, what is, and it was a joke, but also I think it's kind of serious in a way, philosophically, in that, you know, who are these entities? Are they somehow, I think historically we've just, or people throughout the ages have just considered like, well, naturally there's the angels and there's the demons and they just do whatever. But it's like, what's their story? You know, like, Mm-hmm. What's their lot in life? What's the, is this suffering for them, or is it somehow, are they configured mm-hmm. differently? Do they have free will? You know, like how do they figure in? So I think it's interesting that we, in this season, we start getting, you know, peeling back the layers a little bit on some of the demons of the show. So what else do you think we should talk about in terms of the exposition?
I think the other thing that's really important from this season is we start to see more of the backstories of the main characters. We start to see flashbacks to their younger lives, and it gives us sort of a really clear picture of where they came from in a way that I think is central to the challenge that the whole sort of show is making against our traditional views of morality and moral judgment.
Right.
Especially Jason's backstory is horrifying. Every time he opens his, I mean, it's at one point where Tahani says, just literally, I think is the line, every time you describe your backstory, it is horrifying. Like, that's just, she says that because he like describes how his education experience
right.
was
yeah.
a bunch of tugboats tied together in a trap in like in a junkyard. And most of their time was spent selling nudie magazines.
Yeah, and I think that, again, is one of the challenges of this kind of thing. And that's why I say, I mean, I could be totally wrong, but that's why I wonder how many more fake outs and twists we're going to get. Because the more you have to go into these characters' backstories, and the more you paint a three-dimensional picture of who they are and what led them to be how they are, the more it's going to be like, well, why? Again, nobody in the earth ever of all time deserves eternal torment ever. That makes no sense. It's just on its face ridiculous. But it'll look even more ridiculous when you start to, you know, get into like, okay, why are these characters this way? And then that's when you start to realize that it's nobody's fault and that, you know, they're dealt a certain hand. And that kind of transitions into what you wanted to talk about for today. But we also can cover any more exposition that you think we need.
I think that's pretty good. I think we've got all the main things, and if we need to bring anything else in,
sure,
we can. But I think I want to ask you to really get us started because your
yes,
sense
I'll
is
put
very
my
strong.
Daughter in the machine. Oh, no.
You'll put your daughter in the machine. Right. That's all that people yeah. care about is whether or not you put your child in a box. You've said nobody deserves eternal punishment. Do you think that people deserve anything?
Deserve anything. I think that, I don't think I would really frame it in that way. So.
But I did.
Yeah. No. Well, then I would say no, because that yeah. if I would not even frame the question that way, then the answer would be no, I guess. But I think that you'd have to look at what purpose this serves, because I think if you get into the logic of it, and again, this is why I've never believed in religion. Like even from a very young age, I remember, you know, being like maybe 10. I won't exaggerate like Aaron does and say he was picking out satire at the age of 7. I don't really think that was happening.
Is that not a normal age for people to start sure. deconstructing the art yeah. that they're observing?
Exactly. But no, I think I can remember it. Like, let's see. I was allowed to stop going to church at high school, and I started high school at 13, I think, or yeah, right, 13. I was young. I graduated 17. Yeah. So yeah, I think around 10, 11, 12, I can remember thinking, okay, this makes no sense. The idea of a hell makes no sense. And the reason I always thought that, to do a long-winded answer to your question, is kind of this stuff. Like, I didn't have a super sophisticated, you know, all the philosophical terminology, but just this idea that, like, why would anyone deserve this so overwhelmingly disproportionate level of punishment? But to answer your question in, like, do we deserve anything? Like, maybe a short punishment or a long, you know, I would look at it from the perspective of what is being accomplished, you know? And that's when it, I think that gives lie to the whole thing. Did I say that right? I'm totally effed up in my sleep. And so if I say something, ridiculous, I blame that, because traveling ruined me. I haven't caught up and been able to sleep since, but anyway,
so far, so good.
I think it really does show the absurdity of the whole idea, because if you are God or something, or if you're able to be in charge of this whole project that is humans, why do you have two different phases of life? That doesn't make any sense. Why do you have a, you know, okay, there's this short life for no reason for a certain number of years. And then after that is when all the infinite stuff happens. And I think if you look at that, it just becomes obvious that that's far more a product of humans making up a story than it is any like a priori reason why you would have that set up. Like there's no way anyone would think of that, you know, just coming to it fresh. Like you're gonna have this first phase of life, then you'll die. And then that's when the real stuff happened, kind of. That makes no sense. But anyway, also, if there's something wrong, like if you are a bad person for some reason, you know, and any combination of things, if it's Jason and you just, you know, he's born, he's from Florida. I mean, how much worse can it get?
They're all going to the bad place. Yeah.
And, you know, no education, you know, tough upbringing, all that stuff. And let's say legitimately, like he's a person where you'd be like, he's not the lovable dummy that from the show, but let's say it's really just a bad person that commits murder or some sort of crime. And we really don't like this person. We think like, they need to be punished. Well, here on planet Earth, we punish people. We should be punishing people for certain reasons. But if we had access to, if we were some superpower that could say like, okay, well, you know all the reasons why this person did what they did. So like, if you were God, you could literally to the molecule go into Jason's brain and be like, okay, I see. Well, let's just flip this here and do this here. And then that would result in a person who wouldn't do these things. Like, there's no reason. It's a long answer. Sorry. Very long answer to your short question. No one deserves anything. Like, from this afterlife point of view, it makes no sense.
That's great. I like that. You really nailed the answer right there at the end, especially. I think it's hilarious that we are swinging wildly from you disagreeing with me on everything to an episode where you not only love the content, yep, but appear to be fully on board with the philosophy.
Am I fully on board with the philosophy? Oh, your philosophy. It seems not the philosophy of the show.
With the moral luck, with the problem of moral luck as a problem for moral responsibility.
Okay.
So we should put some terminology around the lengthy the intuition ramblings that, yeah, you just laid out there.
Sure.
But I think that was valuable because I think a lot of people feel like you feel. They feel like the idea of the just universe where people who do the bad thing are bad people and get punished and go, right, to the bad place is partly wrong, not just because of the issues of justice and mercy that we talked about when we talked in the first part of our Good Place, which people should go back and check out. I think it was 14. But also that there's just something fundamentally wrong with the idea of people deserving things, given what we know about the nature of people at this point.
Right.
So this all comes from a couple of papers. There's a Williams paper, and then I think the better one is the Nagel Moral Luck paper that I suggested you read, and I definitely recommend everyone else read. It's not too long, and it's, I think, so... Yeah, so the Nagel Moral Luck paper, which I recommend, you know, pretty much everybody read. It's only about 8 or 9 pages, and it's, I think, fairly readable for philosophy writing. And it lays out, it starts with what is, I think, an accurate appraisal of the fundamental requirements for moral responsibility, and then goes on to show that we can't meet those basic requirements. Mm. And the requirement that's most important is called the control principle, the idea that we believe that people should only be held responsible for things that are under their control.
Right.
Which I think is the intuition that you seem to be elucidating pretty strongly there.
Yeah, I mean, so fair? Does that mean, does this rely on like a free will argument or some other way,
exactly,
that kind of is related,
yeah,
to that?
Yep. Nope. This is fundamentally a no free will argument leading to a major problem with moral responsibility. Because as you said, like all of the things that lead to our behavior are factors that are ultimately beyond our control. And therefore, it makes no sense to talk about anyone deserving anything.
Right. Yeah. I think it really does seem like it comes from this power feeling of powerlessness. Like, I mean, there's the control aspect too of religion, but when we talk about like, oh, you know, you said earlier the bad people go to the bad place and then whatever. I feel like a lot of it might come from this idea that we don't, like throughout history, when someone does something to you that's wrong, or when people suffer and you can't do anything about it, it must be comforting to have this feeling of like, well, okay, not in this life, but later on, you know, some other place, it's going to be real bad for them, you know? And it doesn't mm-hmm. seem to be related to any actual concept that makes any sense. You know, like actual philosophy that mm-hmm. stands up to scrutiny. It's more like this emotional desire.
Yeah, and I think that same desire for a sense of justice, there's also a desire for a sense of control, the thing that mm-hmm. we're basically denying people. And it's why I think a lot of people are initially very resistant to this idea that everything is beyond our control, because along with moral responsibility, our sense of self as a worthwhile, independent agent that deserves praise for our good actions appears to be at risk under this view of human nature.
So I mean, this might be too hard of a question for you to answer without mm-hmm. launching into what would be obviously forever on free will. But what are the, I mean, can you give us any quick points on why we don't have that control? I mean, someone listening, you know, might just think, well, I can control. I could decide right now to go stick up a liquor store or not. You know, is that not in my control?
Yeah. So there's sort of two main tracks that I think are important for how to break down this idea of having a sense of control. One of them is the track that Nagel takes directly in his Moral Luck paper, where he lays out the categories of moral luck. So moral luck means when you hold someone morally responsible for something that is beyond their control, and it seems to us to be problematic or paradoxical to do so. So he cites a couple different kinds of this. So obvious ones would be things like the moral luck of how your actions turn out, right? You try to do a good thing and it all goes horribly and there's terrible consequences. But the fact that you were trying to do a good thing seems to a lot of people to mitigate our judgment towards that individual. So that kind of luck is considered, I think, less scary by a lot of people, because the natural move is to turn towards the inner freedom that we think ourselves have and claim that what your intentions were somehow is what we are basing our moral judgments on, even though in reality we do treat accidental, you know, we treat successful murder versus different than unsuccessful murder.
Which we shouldn't, really.
Right. Maybe you think we shouldn't, right? But even adjusting for that, you can't avoid the problem of moral luck, because of the other two main categories that are very important are luck of circumstances and luck of constitution. Mm-hmm. So the situations that you are put into, the challenges you face are entirely beyond your control in any meaningful kind of way. The fact that you're not born in 1930s Germany versus right now radically alters the kind of moral landscape you are forced to deal with. And then the most important, the most challenging one, and this is where the free will argument comes up, is constitutive luck. The idea that even the internal states of the individual, even all of the things we might point to, like their virtue or their character, that could be the source of control and therefore of moral responsibility, all of that is beyond your control too, because it all originates from all the kinds of things that we see highlighted in The Good Place. Your education, your emotional relationships with other people, all of that stuff, especially during the periods of your life that you're really, really not in control, will determine conclusively who you will end up being. And so it doesn't make sense that at some point the self comes along and asserts control in this endless chain of factors that are going beyond your control. And this is why I bring this up in the season two and didn't just dive into it in the season one, because I think it's beautifully highlighted by every character in this story, like Tahani's constant need for attention and affection is obviously so derived good. From... Sorry?
It's so good. I love all the stuff with her sister is so funny.
With a sister and the parents and the like withholding of you know, love. Like, you realize all the different kinds of luck that these characters may have overcome, too. Like, Eleanor is a terrible person, but she's a better person than her parents. Hmm. And, like, she she clearly, in that sequence where she separates from them, shows more presence of self than they show at any point in any of the flashbacks. So I think it's, they haven't consciously called it out on the show yet. I'm hoping they will maybe in season three. But to me, the arc of The Good Place is not just a critique of balancing justice and mercy, but a critique of the very idea of people deserving anything given the way the world actually works.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to speculate, I have a feeling that, like, the way to wrap it all up, and this is not any spoiler, this is just me guessing, but, like, the way to wrap it all up would be almost sort of a solipsistic finish where they all needed to go through this journey to kind of learn lessons, but then ultimately no one was ever really going to be, like, tortured forever. It was just kind of part of this journey of, like, becoming a good person or something in the end. That's what I would guess. But who knows? Maybe they won't.
The Buddhist answer.
Yeah, sort of. You know what I want to ask you, though? And again, it's hard because we can't do a free will episode, but I am curious if, you know, because when we're talking about this, I'm thinking in the back of my mind, all the Christians I've ever argued with that just say, well, we have free will. God gave us free will, so therefore we do deserve whatever, you know, kind of thing. And there's not much you can do with that. It's kind of just a magical free will button that he pushed and gave us that, even though you can't explain how it would possibly function. But there are, of course, lots of people, lots of very smart people who aren't, for not Christian reasons, like Dan Dennett, for example, who believe in compatibilism, like there's like mm-hmm. a way to marry free will with determinism and still have some concept of free will. So I'm wondering if, like, obviously Christians probably aren't going to accept, you know, religious people who think there's a God and a hell and a heaven and all that stuff, they're probably not going to be on board with the nobody deserves anything thing. But what I'm wondering is, do you think that compatibilists have a way of both thinking there is a free will that matters, but also would be on board with what you're saying, which is, oh yeah, sure, but nobody really deserves anything. You know, like, is there a way that can be divided and kind of have your cake and eat it too when it comes to free will?
I mean, there are lots of attempts to do so. And we did a couple of back-to-back episodes on Embrace the Void about Dennett's compatibilism and moral luck. But I do think sort of what you're asking, I think, can I rephrase your question now? What we want to get from both sides of this, right? There's an important intuition that I think is captured by the people who want to believe in free will. And there's an important intuition that is captured by the no free will view. The intuition that I think is valuable to capture from the free will side is a deflated account of free will that has to do with things like autonomy and lack of coercion and the kind of quote-unquote freedom that goes into a flourishing life. We don't mean radical, absurd freedom. We mean, you know, the freedom of letting a child choose which activity it wants to engage in, quote unquote, rather than telling it has to learn this musical instrument and it has to get good at it and it has to perform, etc. So I think if we first make very clear that the commonly understood idea of free will. And I think that the reason that I center my ethics around this idea is because I think it's at the forefront of a lot of debates that are going on in the applied realm of ethics right now. So things like criminal justice reform and immigration. I think it's correct to say that the accident of birth, especially with regard to national borders, is one of the most problematic kinds of moral luck out there, and right. that we need to be sort of actively working to reduce the harms being caused by continuing to treat people as morally different merely because of the accident of their locational birth.
Yeah.
So I think that especially in modern America, the idea of the individual as radically free and separate from the system is the prevailing norm. And so the corrective needs to be strongly towards the deflating of that idea. But we should preserve the idea of more or less free in the sense of more or less coerced actions. Does that sort of answer your question a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. Because one thing I like that Dennett does is kind of illustrate how there can be varying levels of freedom. You know, we think of freedom, free will, you know, moral responsibility as these like binary on-off switches. And I do think there's a compelling point to be made that there are gradient, you know, like there's a gradient of like there could be thing people or entities that are more free than others in a vague way that's kind of hard to define. Kind of like the sand, whatever. What it was.
Yeah, it's I think what you're trying to say is that it's one of those kinds of problems of I'm going to mispronounce this because it's a weird word, but it's like sortie problems, and it means problems having to do with the boundary between not being a collective object and being a collective object.
Yeah, like kind of like emergent phenomenon kind of thing. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's pretty much what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. And it we might not be able to point at, you know, where exactly this pile of sand becomes a pile of sand, you know, at X grains, you know, becomes a pile. But like somewhere in there, there's enough freedom for something that we call moral responsibility kind of thing. And I think that's interesting. And I guess to answer, to go along with you and to summarize how I guess the answer that how I'm hearing it to my question is like, mm-hmm. there is some play in the joints there for enough freedom to have some sort of what we'd call moral responsibility or if we want to define free will as that, but not enough to where you'd still say that like from a bird's eye or God's eye view, even, you're like ultimately responsible for everything that happened to you.
Yeah, I think so. And I think we could say that a good life is one where you are lucky enough to end up having the circumstances and the constitution to be able to follow the moral law, as Kant would say, to be aware of it. And like what he would say is the greatest freedom is in being able to recognize that everything in the universe is subject to a moral law or subject to a law. But human beings are the only entities at his time, right, who could recognize and choose to follow or feel compelled by, I guess, in our no free will language, the truth of the moral law. And so I think, so I still believe in taking personal responsibility, even though I believe all of this no free will stuff about myself. What it means for me is I aim for humility and I aim for forgiveness more towards other individuals, understanding that there may often be unseeable circumstances that are leading to their particular behavior. And like you've been saying, like I aim towards pragmatic solutions to problematic behavior, because what we can do is we can nudge people's behavior into ways that are more functional and produce more happiness. It doesn't mean that we're choosing that in any radical way, but it, you know, we all desire for the world to be a slightly better place. And so we can get that things nudging in that direction. So it's not like there's no ability to change anything that I think goes along with this view. That's sometimes sort of a straw man of the no free will view that everyone's stuck being exactly who they are. So to bring it back to Good Place, right, we can look at Michael, for example, who is very heavily in the direction of bad moral luck because he's a demon. But even he, by the end of second season, is like crying in fear that his friends might have been hurt. That's another key part of moral luck, right? It doesn't mean that if someone's bad, they stay bad forever. If you put them in the right circumstances, there is the chance that a quote-unquote bad person was just a normal person in bad circumstances.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Well, we're out of time. By the way, we do eventually have some sort of Patreon threshold where we're going to extend the show. So keep that in mind if you're making a decision to pledge, because we could go longer and talk about more stuff. But for now, we have to call it. And we have to, a number of things we have to do. First off, we got to thank our top patron, who's going to make Aaron say something that's always fun.
Yep. Once again, big thanks to There Should Definitely Be a Medium Place. And I love the Medium
Finally,
Place stuff.
We got it in the
two.
Right episode. That's good.
Oh, my God. What's his name from Brooklyn Nine-Nine and the League and stuff, who shows up as Janet's boyfriend and then ends up in the... Oh, God. That is one of my favorite sub-arcs in the second season.
Janet's boyfriend?
the creepy, weird guy that she invents to try to get over Jason, who then has his wind chimes for genitals and who ends up at the door of the medium place with two duffel bags full of cocaine. That is like 20 episodes of payoff right
there. So good. Yeah, that's great stuff. And what do you think we are going to talk about next week?
All right, well, next week, I think we're going to go for a big fish. And
we're going to watch Big Fish. Yes, I love that movie.
Big Fish. What?
I love the movie Big Fish. Awesome, finally.
No, that wasn't actually the movie we're watching. No. Is that count as sci-fi? Yeah, maybe. You guys argue about that. No, we're going to do The Matrix because that's a classic and lots of people are familiar with it. And there's lots of good stuff to dive into
there. It's actually good, unlike Aliens. And it holds up. I've watched The Matrix recently, like probably within the last year, and it's still good. And also I will watch it again for the show because I love that movie and it's still good.
And, you know, folks, if you're interested, all y'all who are talking about how we should make Thomas watch more terrible movies, I think we should watch all the Matrix movies. Oh,
man. Yeah, all the Matrix movies for me is just Matrix 1, but I'm told there are other people who consider some weird movies as part of part of that trilogy.
There's an arc. Yeah. There are important arcs. I'm going to explain to you how to watch
the Matrix
properly,
trilogy for me.
Clearly,
is
you need lessons
watching
about how to watch. All right, we're doing this in the after dark. We're doing it after.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, we'll just. It's true. All right, we got to get out of here. Thanks so much for listening. And of course, patrons, stay tuned for some fun after dark. And everybody else, we'll see you next week.
That's all for the main show. But if you'd like to go to patreon.com/0G. You can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
If you genuinely like any non-Matrix 1 Matrix movie, this would really be the collision of our different value systems. Like, 'cause you'll be watching, you know, the architect go on a stupid fucking speech for an hour that's not good. And you'll be like, oh, see, conceptually what's happening here is blah.
I mean,
I'll be like, yeah,
you're
but
not
it
even
sucks.
Remotely wrong. Yeah. There's no, like.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/0G. You can find us on Twitter at @0GPhilosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.